And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning. Good morning, Anila.
Hi,
welcome
Toby.
Welcome to Solidarity Breakfast.
Welcome back from the holidays.
Yeah, hope everyone enjoyed the summer program that we put together. Anila behind the control panel.
So I hope no one could tell the difference. I hope it was as seamless as usual.
It was smooth sailings, and it'll carry us on into this year. It's been already feels like a whole year since we in that 6 weeks that
a
we
lot
were
of
away.
News. A lot of news managed to happen in the 2 weeks that we weren't covering it.
Yeah, and stuff that we'll probably retroactively pick up back on, stuff with Venezuela, stuff with Iran. There's only so much time in this program to touch on, and we've got lots of stuff to talk to you about. Maybe we'll just jump straight into it, just on the eve of Israeli President Isaac Herzog potentially coming to Australia. I'll read Melissa O'Donnell's article from Deep Cup News. International law is clear. Inviting Isaac Herzog to Australia is complicity in genocide. Melissa O'Donnell is an international human rights lawyer. Australia is about to welcome the President of Israel, Isaac Herzog, to its shores. Amnesty Australia, among others, has called for an investigation into Herzog's role in the ongoing Gaza genocide, focusing particularly on his incitement to genocide in October 2023, his egregious invocation against the Palestinian people at large, and his signing of bombs destined to be dropped on the entrapped population of Gaza. Incitement to genocide is an international crime of the highest order, triggering Australia's international obligations to investigate and prosecute. But Herzog's role is much more insidious than the specific words and actions. His visit is a continuation of his function throughout this genocide, and this invitation directly embroils Australia in these crimes. The presidency of Israel is a largely ceremonial role, except for some very limited powers. The president has no executive function and is therefore not in a position of command responsibility that is often key to establishing individual criminal responsibility for genocide. Herzog's ceremonial function, though, should not be underestimated. Since October 2023, Herzog has engaged in at least 11 diplomatic visits, including the UAE, Germany and the Baltic states, and the USA, almost the same number as the Israeli foreign minister. This has included representing Israel at significant international fora, including the World Economic Forum twice, the United Nations Climate Change Conference. Business as usual, it would seem. By contrast, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has only visited the United States and Hungary since October 2023, as his direct responsibility is clearer and many countries have pledged to honour the arrest warrant issued against Netanyahu by the International Criminal Court in 2024. The president travels where the prime minister cannot. Normalization of Israel's atrocities has been key to its settler colonial enterprise and its capacity to persist in such enduring and heinous conduct for more than 7 decades. As global outrage has deepened against the most recent genocidal onslaught, the diplomatic arena has become a key site of Israel's public relations strategy. In her most recent report, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, set out her legal finding that without diplomatic cover from other states, Israel would not have been able to commit this genocide. States like Canada, Australia, and New Zealand were specifically identified for their diplomacy at key moments that actually served to dissipate rising global pressure and effectively buy more time for Israel's genocidal military strategy. Such was this diplomatic conduct that it was assessed for complicity in genocide, rather than how it was generally portrayed as a welcome political objection to Israeli conduct. Australia's invitation of the Israeli president at this moment must be added to this dossier of its complicity. If Germany can be forced by Nicaragua to answer for its conduct vis-a-vis Israel before the International Court of Justice, so too could Australia if any other state were so inclined. And you can read the rest of that at Deep Cut News.
We've also had some news from Oxfam. They've recently released their global inequality report, Resisting the Rule of the Rich, Protecting Freedom from Billionaire Power. And they found that billionaire wealth rose by more than 16% last year, reaching a record-breaking $18.3 trillion. I think last year as well, billionaire wealth increased three times faster than the average annual rate over the previous 5 years. And since 2020, billionaire wealth has grown by 81%. That's immense, immense rate of growth. Moving on to some international news, the United States and the Iranian governments met this week about Tehran's nuclear program. The talks were the first between the US and Iran since June 2025, when the US joined Israel's war against Iran and bombed its nuclear and military sites. It follows weeks of escalating tensions between Washington and Tehran, with US warships gathered near Iranian coastal waters, and nearly a month after a wave of nationwide protests swept across Iran against the clerical leadership. We've also had this week the end of the New START nuclear arms control treaty between the US and Russia, without plans for a replacement treaty. In a statement, the Deep Cuts Commission, a group of experts and former officials who focus on US-Russia arms control, said, quote, "We express our profound concern that following the expiration of the US-Russian treaty on measures for the further reduction and limitation of strategic offensive arms, otherwise known as New START, on the 5th of February, there will be no bilateral nuclear arms control agreements between the two countries for the first time in decades." And that is following a general trend that we've seen in the last year or so of kind of a breakdown of commitments to arms control treaties across the world. So things aren't looking good in terms of pacifism.
Yeah, and especially in a climate where there's escalating far-right governments being elected. This week, Costa Rican president-elect Laura Fernandez's decisive win handed her right-wing sovereign people's party, the PPSO, a majority in Congress, securing 31 of 57 seats, the first time since 1990 that one party controls both the presidency and the legislature, Reuters reported. The PPSO fell short of the 38-seat supermajority, meaning it can pass laws and budgets, but must negotiate for reforms requiring broader support as opposition parties regroup after heavy losses. So we're seeing pretty much the world over the establishing of these far-right governments that have broad support. Here we've seen reported a lot on what Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party is rallying around wedge issues like stopping migration after the fallout of people's disenchantment with big political parties and big political projects. We've seen the Greens in a crisis.
Not to mention the complete collapse of the LNP's kind of leadership structures. So not to give One Nation too much credit, I think the LNP has helped them out significantly.
Yeah, absolutely. The last bit of news maybe from the international front is that Syrian forces have entered Qamishli under a ceasefire deal. Syrian government forces began entering the northeastern city of Qamishli on Tuesday to assume security duties under a ceasefire agreement with Kurdish-led forces. Syria's state news agency Sana reported, citing that the country's interior minister, the move follows a deal in which the Syrian Democratic Forces agreed to integrate into the Syrian army institutions after weeks of clashes as President Ahmed al-Sharaa's government seeks to consolidate control following the fall of longtime leader Bashar al-Assad in December 2024. So that means the Rojava project has de facto ended, and we've seen a convoy this week of activists from all over the world and Europe be stopped in Turkey and arrested and deported for trying to cross the territory and assist the autonomous project of Rojava. We'll go now to the Sydney rally on the 1st of February, recorded as always by Vivian. We thank for her for all her work. You can catch more of her at the Climate Action Show on Monday at 5 p.m. or 5:30. Anyway, we'll hear from Vivian.
There was a huge Palestine Action rally in Sydney on Sunday, February the 1st. It was in Hyde Park, and I'd say there were about 2,000 people there gathered under the trees. The context was the imminent visit of Israel's president, Isaac Herzog. On the night of the terror attack at Bondi, I was in the park with my dog and I saw hundreds of police cars and riot police dashing towards the beach, towards the coast. And then later at home, I heard on the radio about 10 o'clock that night on ABC Radio, President of Israel lecturing our Prime Minister on his weakness. He said that he had permitted 2 years of unrestrained anti-Semitic rage on the streets of Australia. I felt this was foreign interference of the first order. Our Prime Minister has invited Herzog here on the 9th of February. Groups such as Amnesty International and the Australian Centre for International Justice are also angry about this visitor who has presided over the starvation and collective punishment of Palestinians in Gaza. As you will hear, some are calling for him to be arrested if he comes, but none of this is anti-Semitic. In fact, the Jewish Council of Australia is also calling for his visit to be cancelled. First, you'll hear Mr. Shamik Badra speaking about his family members mourned but unburied beneath the rubble in Gaza.
For more than 2 years, we haven't known where their bodies are.
Then Senator Merin Faruqi from the Australian Federal Parliament. And joining them together, the two MCs from Palestine Action Group, Amal Nasser and Josh Lees.
We want to point out as well that it's because of that big Invasion Day march that defies the Christmas ban on protests in this state. It's because of that march that we are allowed to march here today. This is the world Christmas has created, the kind of Orwellian, nightmarish world where the criminals accuse us of criminality, where the racists accuse us of racism, where the world's biggest terrorists accuse us of being responsible for terrorism. And as Judith said, and as Amal has said, of course this mass movement has done the exact opposite of what they say. This mass movement has been a bulwark against all forms of racism in society for the past 2.5 years. Where else in society do we have people from all different backgrounds and faiths marching together to condemn racism, to celebrate what should be our joint values as human beings, fighting for the liberation and equality of all of us on this planet, from Sydney to Gaza and everywhere else? And we know, of course, that there are two main causes of anti-Semitism in the world today. The one, of course, is the growth, the despicable growth of the extreme right and the Nazis around the world. And of course, we all remember the Elon Musk Hitler salute that all of our politicians refused to condemn and refused to condemn and refused to even say that's what it was. And of course, we know about the Nazis on the street who are all backed by the same Murdoch newspapers, you know, who allowed that movement to come into existence, who then have the nerve to call us anti-Semites. So that is the one key pillar of anti-Semitism today, is the far right, is fascist, neo-Nazis, and we are part of the fight against those people. And of course, we salute everyone in Minneapolis and Minnesota standing up against Trump and his fascist ice gang. And the other key cause of anti-Semitism today is, of course, the actions of Israel and people's mistaken, our belief that Israel acts in the name of Jewish people in the world. And of course, that is a mistaken belief. And again, who else in society has done as much as what we all have in the past 2.5 years to say that that is wrong, to say that we do distinguish between the acts of a criminal Israeli state and Jewish people in the world, that we do not blame one for the actions of the other. No one else has done that. And of course, the key people deliberately conflating those things are our government, our media, and our Israel lobby in this country. And as Judith pointed out, now we have a despicable and dangerous situation where they are telling the people of this country that our rights have to be taken away, our rights to free speech, our rights to protest, our rights to even speak up against the genocide have to be taken away, supposedly in the interest of Jewish safety. This is a disgusting argument, a despicable argument. We are told, literally today, you can either oppose the genocide in Gaza or you can oppose the terrorist attack in Bondi. We are being told that you cannot oppose both. This is an absolutely sick world they are trying to create. And we are the people who reject that. We condemn the despicable actions of Bondi and we condemn the despicable genocide in Gaza. It's not very hard to do. The story is, of course, the ultimate reason why we need to keep fighting, why they won't shut us up, and why it's so obscene that they would tour this war criminal president to come to Australia.
As a Palestinian from Gaza, I'd like to thank you for supporting us. Thank you for standing here today. Thank you for standing for justice in Palestine and Gaza. Your solidarity gives us hope. Let me tell you what those policy did. My father was old. My father was sick. He died without enough medicine, enough food, enough water. Not by accident, but because of deliberate policy. My brother was a physiotherapist. He helped people. His wife was a doctor. She saved lives. Her father was also a doctor. They believe in humanity. They were killed along with their four children. And my brother and his family didn't just die, they disappeared. For more than 2 years, we haven't known where their bodies are. We were told they are still under the rubble. We couldn't bury them. We couldn't say goodbye. We couldn't grieve with dignity. This is not only death, this is erasure. This is what genocide looks like in real life. When families are denied even the dignity of a grave, this is what incitement produces. This is what dehumanization does. And now we are told that the man who defended these policies is welcome in Australia. There should be no red carpet for incitement, no handshakes over mass graves.
And next week our leaders will shake his hands. They will welcome him with open arms when the only thing that they can be doing the second he lands in this country is arresting him and not allowing Israel to continue to act with impunity. But they will justify this and they will say it's okay.
Assalamu alaikum. I stand before you today, a loud and proud brown migrant Muslim woman who is unashamedly and unapologetically pro-Palestine and anti-genocide. And no matter what they throw at us, I will never shy away from being who I am. And I will never shy away from standing up and speaking out for justice. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people continue to bear the brunt of violence, discrimination, and racism in these colonial systems. And if we needed any more evidence of how little First Nations lives matter to Labour governments, federal and state, it happened on Invasion Day. In Boorloo, a bomb was thrown into a crowd of First Nations people and their allies. And the silence from the establishment has been deafening. And let me tell you this, the silence is not accidental. It reflects a political culture that has normalized violence against First Nations people and treats it as unworthy of urgency or outrage. For the last 2 years, the Albanese and Minns Labour governments have searched for ways to shut us down, to shut down the anti-genocide, pro-peace movement of people that show solidarity with Palestine. And they do think that they have finally found a way through their reckless, dangerous, and divisive laws, which are an assault on democratic rights and freedoms. With this so-called ceasefire, which we all know is not really a ceasefire, as Palestinians are killed every single day. 31 Palestinians were killed just overnight under the so-called ceasefire. But we are now seeing a deliberate plan to insulate and protect the Israeli government from any accountability and any consequences, because they are building the power to implement a Trump-style crackdown on free speech, including attempts to ban phrases and protests against a genocidal state. It is disgraceful, this descent into authoritarianism, with the government deciding what you can say, how you can say it, and when you can say it. But so many of you being here today shows that we will fight this. Will we fight this? And in their most recent move, just this morning, the Albanese government has refused to sign even a statement condemning Israel for demolishing UNRWA's East Jerusalem headquarters. A statement signed by 11 countries, including their allies, Canada, UK, and France. So it seems they have now stopped even pretending that they care. But here's the thing. The Prime Minister does not speak for us. He cannot pull wool over our eyes, no matter how much he tries to defend the visit of Israel's president. Israel has massacred, bombed, and dehumanized Palestinians for decades, and is now on a genocidal mission to erase them. So we will not let Herzog's visit go unchallenged. We will not allow hard-won rights to be stripped away quietly and without resistance. Because unlike the Labour government, we take our moral responsibilities seriously. And we take our strength from decades of resistance and resilience of the Palestinian people and the hundreds of years of resistance and resilience of First Nations people right in this country. So to Anthony Albanese and to Chris Minns, hear this very clearly and loudly. Pass as many anti-democratic laws as you want with your mates in the Liberal Party. You will not silence us. You may try and criminalize solidarity, but you will not crush us. You will never crush us. We are united on the streets of this country, in the hundreds, in the thousands, in the millions. War criminals are not welcome here. Yeah. Prime Minister, cancel Herzog's visit. Yeah. And while you're at it, rip up and reject Trump's invitation to join the farcical imperialist so-called Board of Peace. Rip it up! May not want to hold Israel to account, but be sure of one thing. We will hold the Labour government to account. Yeah. And we will not stop talking about Palestine. Palestine will be free from the river to the sea.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
College, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio
on 8:55 AM.
That was so cute.
Yeah, Braybrook City, Braybrook College, 3CR, Solidarity Breakfast. We heard there from Vivian, a lot of people as well, Josh Lees, Marine Faruqi, some Palestinian refugees there as well. We'll go now to an interview that I did with friend of the show, Jerry Georgiados, when I was in WA, and who updates us on a book that he's most recently released, doing a forensic analysis of the case of Cleveland Dodd, Cleveland Dodd's life, and how youth justice has failed not just Cleveland Dodd, but a lot of people in the corrections system. Just a note of warning, if anything affects, there'll be you during this interview. There is lots of talk about suicidality, especially First Nation stuff. The VACCHO, the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, has released a Black Track Service Directory. So this is an online directory you can find at blktrx.org.au, which locates all MobSafe social services for and helplines, as well as obviously Lifeline and stuff like that. So be sure to go check that out. And we'll hear from Jerry now. Jerry, good to be back with you, this time in the comfort of your home. Thanks for taking the time to talk to our listeners. How have you been, and what's sort of been the focus since the last time we dropped in and heard a bit about what's going on?
Firstly, more thanks go to you for talking about dropping in. You've come all the way from Melbourne to Perth, obviously for family, but you've included me in, and gets me out to Melbourne listeners. And I'd love to update them on all things that matter, that should matter, particularly about vulnerable people, people marginalised, people who make up the prison population, juvenile, children's prisons and adult prisons. They're the forgotten, and there's a high recidivism rate because we don't support them. We work carcerally, brutally, confinement, and don't work to understand their lives and the unfairnesses that they actually have in the beginning of life, and that they've suffered with no fault of their own and not had the nurture that they should have had. Some of it's been absent from the beginning, and some of it's been stressing because their parents have felt the same predicaments that they felt, marginalised and left behind by the sins of the nation. So it's up to us to make the difference in people's lives, or get others to understand, even premiers and ministers and political entities or whatever, to understand that we should be leaving no one behind, holding no one back, and we definitely do that. We do leave people behind, despite what politicians say, and we do that intentionally, and we hold someone back, like prisoners. There's no prisoner rights, there's no Medicare for prisoners, so they come out worse than what they went in. It's only less than a couple of months ago we launched a book. So I wrote a book, not because I believe in books. I'm a firm believer that no book has ever changed the world to its betterment, to its collective betterment, or to its potential best that we could be. And I've always been, even though I've been a researcher and I've done a lot of research work and research projects and even ghostwritten quite a few major texts, I took this book on because the mother asked me to, the mother of Cleveland Dodd. The book's actually called Cleveland Dodd, Child of the Desert Sunrise. And he was 16. He died in Unit 18 of Banksy Hill Prison. Unit 18's in segregated in an adult prison, Casuarina Prison, a maximum security prison. 1,000 adults in there, and any number of kids have been in there, from half a dozen to about 20 at a time, and it's still open. We objected. Unit 18. It was formed in 2023 in July. It was rushed into existence because they couldn't. Well, they were doing all things wrong by the way they were coming across to the children inside Banksia Hill, and all sorts of volatility exploded. Longings and pains and sufferings translated as protests and rebelliousness and conduct, which most people find unbecoming. It has been their suffering and their surround since the beginning of life, wanting to, no one listens to them, and they play out and act out. And all they're doing is really calling out for help to get the support that they should be getting, which they don't get. We've endured 2 years of a coronial inquest. The findings came in on December the 8th, and I was there at the coroner's court with the mother, Nadine Dodd, when we got the findings. They were pretty strong findings for the most part. Not everything on the wish list for bleeding heart leftists like myself and for people who want to make a difference in people's lives, turning them around. which has been my life spent. But I believe in doing everything that we can by everybody, and starting at the bottom end up, and not turning our downtrodden into prisons, which are the rubbish tips of this nation. 132 prisons in this nation, 17 juvenile prisons, children's prison, and 115 adult prisons. And they're as if they're the rubbish tips of this nation. That's how they're treated. So, you know, people are nominally locked up for 12 hours overnight, and 12 hours is half the day, and then it can be rolling lockdowns of 24 hours straight at a whim's notice, and or on average 16 to 17 hours is not uncommon. And sometimes in adult prisons there's gross overcrowding, so there's three or four to a prison cell. And in children's prisons it's usually one to a cell, but sometimes two, but one to a cell. But, you know, human spirit is an immortal call. Wasn't born into being confined in small spaces that you can, in some of these prison cells you can touch both walls by outstretching your arms. And it's a stir-crazy existence, and that we've got this is an abomination. We've got 18th century prisons here in the Western world, if we can say that, maybe most of the world, with the exception of more progressive countries like the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, which actually have a whole different experience. It's custodial, but it's not bars, it's unlocked doors. And it's human respect and dignity, and they have the lowest recidivism rates. So if we want to compel change, we've got to understand what they do, because what they do works. 90% of children in Norway, for instance, 90% of children in Norway who offend once do not offend again. That's what we've got to take away as a lesson. 90% of children that offend once in Western Australia and pretty much across the country offend again. Not just twice, but three and four and five and six times. And some children have gone in 20, 30, 40 times in their ages 10 to 18 and have spent all their teens from 13 to 18, all their birthdays in children's prisons. So that's what we're faced with in this country. We've got the financial firepower in this country, no matter what's being said about tight budgets and gross domestic product and productivity. This nation is an affluent nation, one of the richest on the planet, the 12th richest in fact, and it has a treasure trove of $16 trillion, which it doesn't talk about. It only talks about the GDP and the GSP, gross state product or gross domestic product from on the national level. And it concocts all this story about the budget that we have. What we have in this nation is the GDP, which is the pay packet of any a similar analogy to a household, convoluted with the capacity of this nation's financial fiscal power, when we don't include the treasure trove of $15 trillion in that equation of the liquid and capital assets this country actually has. So we have to take notice of the facts and work with the facts, not with the propaganda. And it actually leaves people behind, because there's an assumption, it's a demonizing assumption, we can't afford to. We can afford to. And we can afford what the Norwegians actually have, life transformative, immersive culture that works with young people to turn their lives around. And they've got the lowest recidivism rates, not just in Europe, but the world.
And so you've outlined all this in your book.
I have. There's a dedication I'd like to read from the book, because it tells the whole story. Because, as I said, I'm not one who believes in books, but I wrote it as a memoir to young one, Cleveland, whose name we've got permission to mention from the mother and all the family and the father too. And I wrote in the dedication, "Thank you to Nadine, Cleveland's mum, who both insisted and inspired me to write this book. Most days of the last 2 years we spoke of the injustices Cleveland endured, which his family had been devastated by. Nadine's harrowing journey guided me to write this book. Nadine prosecuted the importance of writing, telling her son's tragedy. Nadine does not believe that her son's tragedy was not foreseeable. Nadine asked me to include what I've been through the last 2 decades in calling out Australia's children's prisons. We were all harangued by the loss of Cleveland. Of every child who should have a better life, if Banksia Hill, for instance, was and is a bastion of the life transformative, instead of a turnstile to adult incarceration. I believe no book makes a significant difference. Well, of course, I hope I am wrong. Nadine hopes that this testament to Cleveland brings on the investiture of changes that, if they had been realised decades ago, would have ensured the thriving of Cleveland. It's a forensic detail of everything that led up to Cleveland's death, a forensic detail of the boy's life before incarceration in child's prison, before being failed the first time at Banksia Hill. Actually, the first time he was failed was with the courts. They should have actually got him into life transformative diversionary programs. Most of them don't exist, but that's what they should be compelling governments to actually put in place. Justices have that capacity. And the president of the Children's Court, as a result of this, actually has stood up and actually has been rarer than once in a generation a leading figure. The president of the Children's Court is also a presiding judge in the Children's Court. has said more needs to be done. And if you want to create a criminal or a monster, this is how you do it, by making them go stir crazy behind bars and invalidating their sufferings and their unfairnesses. And we can't change or turn around the life of a young one. An 11-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, 15, 17, 18-year-old, then who are we? What sort of society are we? What sort of society are we creating? You know, prepared to demonize children until they become recidivists as adults and then finish up and ruin lives going in and out of our prisons for longer periods and what they were doing as children in children's prisons. I've written about the forensic detail, the coroner's court's limitations, the government's failings, the Department of Corrective Services' failings, over the strongest possible language, truthful language, honest language, and that's the only way to exact any change. And we launched the book. I had 10 weeks to write it because she wanted it out by the anniversary, or the sad anniversary, of her child's death, which for her was the 12th of October and not the 19th of October of 2023, because he was found in his cell, but he had passed away. And no amount of lying by government or corrective services can take that away. But they were basically breathing air when the paramedics came into a corpse. They didn't want to say at the time because they had freaked out. This was going to be the first child death in Banksia Hill or Unit 18. They're one and the same in the children's prison in Western Australia. They've been under the pump for years by people like myself who would gain traction in the media to get across the world's record high suicide rates, suicidality, sorry, and suicide attempts, which was actually Banksia Hill. All the data I could collect that was robust around the world, Banksia Hill outstripped everyone. So we were the world's highest suicidality rates, world's highest self-harms, world's highest number of attempted suicides, and yet we were fortunate enough to have one. But to say that it was not foreseeable, or to blatantly say that it was foreseeable, is an insult to this boy and the boy that died 10 months later, also by suicide, a white boy, whose name I won't mention because I don't have permission from the family to do so. But he cried out for help, and he went in and out, and he could have been helped. There's a long story there in itself. But 10 months after Cleveland passed away, this young boy also passed away. So what that goes to, it's not a black problem or a white problem. It's a carceral problem. It's a broken system. It's a systemic problem in disrepair. And at the very least, needs systemic repair or reconfiguration. And actually to work to the rehabilitative, the restorative, the life transformative. But this book's actually everything about this boy's life, the capability that he had. He was culturally rich, being a Wangai boy, Matu boy, a Yamaji boy. And his identity was robust and strong. He had what most kids who from First Nations families don't have, the First Peoples, who finish up incarcerated, a mapping of his family history. He was actually a merit-based student. He was highly successful at school, and it was only his longing to find his father's identity that led him to Mikatara, where he was without his mum and without his siblings, that he went astray on his own a bit and finished up incarcerated. And from then on, he got on the drug to address issues about absence of parent, of a father that he loved dearly, who loved him also. But he'd been in Banksia Hill himself as a child, 3 or 4 years of time spent, almost 4 years of time spent in Banksia. And when he was 15, when he was 16, the mother was 15, and she was pregnant to a young one, Cleveland. The father spent the first 8 months of the mum's pregnancy in Banksia Hill. So that's intergenerational. It's intergenerational sins of the nation. It's intergenerational deaths in custody. It's intergenerational trauma. It's intergenerational poverty. Let's remember that the First Peoples had been held back, unlike migrants, who, as hard as they had their working lives, and they had the opportunity, at least not denied to them, to leave a legacy and support their young ones, unlike till the 1960s, 70s, in some parts of the country, till today, where they were held back by not having the education they could have, not being allowed to get educated when they should have, and not being supported to get an education today, when poverty now, part of that intergenerational poverty, has held them back. And we need the rapid affirmative action to do so. So this book doesn't spend its time calling out all the historical narratives, because we know them. It's specific to the individuated, of his circumstance, pre-Banksia, during Banksia, in Unit 18. He was first failed by the courts, then failed by the Banksia Hill mob. Because if you finish up in Unit 18, you've been failed at Banksia. And he finished up at Unit 18 because of Banksia. So, and so did all the others there. So instead of working even harder with them in some morning and more immersively, we just carcerally deprived them further of their liberty. And they finished, out of the last 86 days of his life, he spent 75 days of those 86 days, 23 hours to 24 hours of those days incarcerated. They've added up the minutes, and it was 4 hours and 36 minutes he had out in those 86 days.
And this is an important book to come out now, especially since the Northern Territory has continued its assault on children, lowering the age of criminal responsibility to 10, legislating spit hoods to be back on. This is a nationwide problem.
Well, they went forwards a little bit, then they went backwards. They actually legislated to raise the age from 10 to 12. Then they rescinded that because of scaremongering and outcries of community, because of community safety issues and crime, youth crime. But what they didn't do at that time was actually fund everything that should have been funded to support these young kids to turn their lives around. Because it's been my experience that if you work with someone, no matter how young or how old, if you work with them for long enough and believe in them until they believe in themselves, that actually comes to happen. They do believe in themselves. But, you know, this boy had a good start in life, and he wasn't the usual child, the suffering from the beginning of life that other children have had. He was failed by circumstances that were behoven on him, weaved in by his visit to Meekatharra, and being on his own a lot of the time and with a crowd that has never been supported itself to get an education to be strong in their directions. Because racism still exists in this country, classism exists in this country, and in some places like Meekatharra and Kalgoorlie and all over this country in remote and regional communities that are not predominantly First Nations people, but the invader, I don't call them settlers, the invader, and they've never worked to address these issues collectively. They've only worked to put some affirmative actions in to homogenise them as part of the deal to get ahead. So in the very least, they didn't even do that across the board. So in the end, he was let down by a state that also took away. So this is why I say we leave people behind, but we also hold them back. We held this child back. Society held this child back. In the book, I actually say it clearly. Australia killed Cleveland Dodd. Australia killed Cleveland Dodd. That's what I want listeners and readers to actually get from this. And we sold 2,000 books in 2 weeks.
Saying that the sales of this book will go to support the family, something that the state also isn't doing.
Well, the state is beholden to support, and there's compensability that should arise from that, but that doesn't address immediate needs and concerns. It's taken me sometimes 6, 7, 8 years to get compensation for families from deaths in custody, and that's a sad record, because there are families with teenagers that could have been supported at that time, and their teenage years are wiped away waiting, and there's more dire circumstance in their lives as we hold them back. But we've helped raise the funds for the gravestone for the child, which is what the mother wanted. And we've dedicated quite a bit of the proceeds to the children getting an education. I know not everybody likes boarding school, but it's their only opportunity, these ones, because it's a single parent mum, 6 children, 5 who remain. And the memory of Cleveland, the eldest child, who'd won his brothers educated, and he loved school. He loved school. He was good with the guitar. He could horseback ride. He was a great painter and artist, which most of the nation has seen from his artworks that we've got out. Even his last artwork, it's in the book. He did that 4 weeks before in jail, in Unit 18, before he passed away. But I did say earlier he passed on the October the 12th. Formally, it's October the 19th. I was there at the hospital at ICU at the invitation of the family, their insistence that I did. Roger Cook helped me, the WA Premier, when I asked him to get the handcuffs off the father and the shackles off his legs so he could embrace his child that last day in hospital. And he's helped me a bit with the family, so he's been ultra empathetic that way, but that hasn't translated to the systemic repair that needs to happen. It's improved, but it's nowhere near the mountain slime of repair that needs to be done to guarantee the well-being of every child who goes in there and the propensity for their improved life circumstance. So,
the Black Lives Matter movement is not going away here or overseas. It gives me hope seeing the numbers of people that turn out to these Invasion Day demonstrations in Melbourne. It gives me the understanding that we will win, folks. We will succeed!
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR, 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your dial.
A week, Solidarity Bricky Team listener, when, well, it's been a number of weeks, hasn't it? And hang on, sorry team, sorry listener, but there's breaking news. It's unconfirmed, we'll have to check this out, but there's a report coming in that Venezuela has invaded Washington and taken US of the UN of the US of the world big supremo Donald Trump or the poor hostage, arrested him on charges of narcissism and sheer stupidity, thrown him into a cell in Caracas along with Melania. Melania, incidentally, there's a not-to-be-missed cinematic experience. The reports are that a number of US OBS civilians were killed and injured, but no casualties in the Venezuelan invading force, leading Venezuela to boast no one was killed. Obviously, we'll have to confirm this, but if it's true, big Supremo Anthony Albanese, comment? If these reports prove to be true, this is the most disgraceful and heinous attack on world order. No country has the right to march into another country and arrest and kidnap the big supremo. We call on Venezuela to release President Trump or the poor and the First Lady immediately and refrain from threats and aggression and violence against its neighbour. Good. That should do the trick. Incidentally, I don't recall you saying that when the US OBS invaded Venezuela and kidnapped Maduro. Quite simply because there is no comparison. But the minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Leftwing, and I did say we would keep an eye on the situation, which I'm sure you'll understand is very, very strong diplomatic language. It certainly is. It's right up there with your very, very strong diplomatic language these past 2.5 years over the Zion slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation. Exactly. Although we wouldn't use your emotive terms like slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation. No? What would you use? Zion's right to defend itself. And as Anthony, Penny and the team prepare to welcome the Zion president, alleged by a UN of the US of the UN of the World inquiry to have incited genocide, we recall the usual suspects were highly critical of the Sydney Biennale acclaimed curator Hoor El Kassimi because she had expressed concern over the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, on which she's not exactly an orphan. Matter now resolved. The Zionist Board of Deputies President has agreed to, quote, preview and critique the exhibitions and recommend removal of any he deems to be anti-Semitic. And at first glance, there seemed to be a hell of a lot of those, like at least a third had expressed anti-Zionism, and that he knows is anti-Semitic. On which, did anyone note the slightly different reaction to a terrorist bomb thrown into a terra nullius non-land, non-people invasion day event? No problem, the non-land, non-people are used to being non-people. No screaming for a His Most Gracious Majesty con mission. Of course, during the break, we've also had the tennis, a festival of gluttonous indulgence and networking for the filthy rich, the A-list set and the wannabes paid for by the plebs. On the ever-expanding land grab, land the indulgers would never have dreamed of going anywhere near when it was the locale for the Yarrabang speakers and the destination for huge May Day marches before it was handed to the elite by the state socialists. Which also brings us back to the Maduro kidnapping. What's the connection, I hear you say? Well, among the charges laid against the Venezuelan was being in possession of a machine gun. The first we'd heard, this had become an international crime. It certainly should be, but then what were the train killers who arrested him carrying? Anyway, Donald warned at the outset of the tennis that the country of any player who defeated a US OBS player would face huge tariffs and other penalties, including a possible invasion and arrest of its big supremo, and the player himself arrested and whisked off to face justice US OBS style, charged with the heinous international crime of being in possession of a tennis racket. The most horrible person ever. The elite celebrating their privilege on a working class sacred site was appropriate given the tennis exploits child slave labour. Imagine if the players had to pick up the balls themselves in exchange for the millions they reap. When asked if True Blue Aussie would pay ball kids like other major tournaments, Supremo Craig Telly the Prophets gave a big no, pointing out they didn't even have to pay for their uniforms and they were able to be up close to their heroes. Further, Craig wants to get rid of the umpires who, damn it, cost money. To soak up the atmosphere, the week that was spoke to one of the A-listers in turn, soaking up a champers and enjoying a huge lobster. What do you think of the tennis, we asked. Tennis? There's tennis? On matters industrial, like slave labour, top marks for innovation to a mob called U-Turn, which deals with youth homelessness, coming up with the perfect solution to the gender pay gap after its women workers complained about pay inequality compared to its male workers. The perfect solution? It slashed the men's pay. We believe the decision is fair, equitable and in the best interests of the intensive family support team and U-Turn as a whole, Supremo James Blevin, real name, announced. The men, 10 grand worse off, selfishly and incredibly, didn't agree. Taking the matter to the Fair Work, True Blue Aussie, no longer Work Choices, just looks like it con mission, which found they had a case and the matter has been referred to conference. In the meantime, we assume the greedy women who kick-started the whole saga remain 10 grand worse off. Meanwhile, concrete giant Bored Up All Workers is distraught. The evil transport union is attempting to thwart its commendable efforts to, quote, modernise outdated contract negotiations and move to an industry standard approach for drivers using a model that incentivises uptime and productivity. What a worthy ambition, and what an innovative way to incentivise uptime and productivity. Offer lower terms and conditions and threaten workers with the sack or, sorry, with sadly having to be let go if they don't accept the generous offer, prompting the union to show how evil it is. Telling your drivers you'll sack them if they don't accept lower terms and conditions is clearly a Hobson's choice and it's unacceptable, it raved. Master Builders Profits Association Supremo Danita warned workers, the union position would open up a Pandora's box, add constraints on the supply chain, add costs and more pain for homeowners and renters. If only the evil union could comprehend the damage wages and conditions cause. And during the break, waste distributor Clean Away the Bodies had its ninth worker death in 3 years, real figure, but not without suffering for its executives. Given its fatalities and increases in serious injuries, the board slashed executive bonuses by 30%, reducing Supremo Mark Schubert's, real name again, take-home to a mere $4.2 million. And sitting in his boardroom counting house will ensure Mark is safe from death and injury. And irresponsible unions are also asking Safe Work True Blue Aussie for a national standard to stop work in extreme heat, with construction labourers, airport ground staff, horticultural workers and miners the most affected. One ground staff worker saying people suffered heat stroke, dizziness and or felt faint during Melbourne's recent heat wave. You just can't keep working in that environment, he complained. Workers are such whingers, aren't they? It might be 45 degrees, but on the tarmac it's like 60. When he had gathered his breath from the audacity of such sloth, the Civil Contractors Profits Association's Nicholas Proud to Profit warned this would delay major projects, including the Brisbane Olympics. See, it's always hot in Brisbane, he said. And true to form, our old mate Innes Will Costa, the workers of the True Blue Aussie Industry Profits Group, said the proposal was simply unworkable, presumably because he demands work and not unwork. It fails to acknowledge the diversity of True Blue Aussie workplaces, he proved his point. We presume on hot days you're in an air-conditioned office, Innes. Now, that's irrelevant. I feel the heat of irresponsible and economy-damaging claims by evil unions and lazy, avaricious workers. Poor Innes. And poor Innes's problems didn't end there. No, listener, no. As the campaign for a four-day week also ramped up, a shattered Innes was also forced to warn this too would set a very risky precedent. With caring employers, it's just one threat after another, isn't it? So there must have been some relief when a little scrap of good news came their way. On the Reserve Losses Bank's forecast, real wages will go backwards until at least the middle of next year. That'll teach workers the price of greed. And as the bank's Michelle Bulldust announced an interest rate hike, she showed her empathy. She knows it will hurt people, but her responsibility is to the economy, showing the economy is far more important than people. And as we are engrossed with that cinematic masterpiece Melania, we are equally engrossed with the self-mutilation of the caring business class and hayseed and sheepshit parties, bringing us to a hold-up in the release of the internal party report into last year's election wipeout, as it seems that answer to future trivia quizzes, Constable Peter Duffer is threatening to sue for defamation, like maybe it suggests he had something to do with it. Those, unlike Pete, who may think the extreme weather across the globe, that heat on the tarmac, has something to do with climate change, if there is such a thing, can rest assured there's obviously no connection, else the responsible resource behemoth polluters would not be extending coal mines and the lives of coal mines, gas, 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 oil, 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 attacking government as a lobby, including the big Trubler Aussie, Rio Tinto the Planet, Glen Rotten to the Core, our very own Gina, Woodside with profits, Chevron, calling for the government to make it even easier to, quote, capitalise on a generational opportunity in global energy and resource markets. Generational opportunity, capitalise. How can poor old Mother Earth compete with that? Great behemoth polluters so dedicated to the transition from themselves. Finally, a clarification for those who thought quite naively that a ceasefire meant, wait for it, you're not going to believe this, meant a ceasefire. No, no, when Zion signs a ceasefire, it means it will slaughter, destruct, genocide and starve a little less than before the ceasefire. But the other party must abide by every clause, and then some of it will be, or else it will be slaughtered, destroyed, genocided and starved even more. Oh, and that ever-expanding list of close, close friends of sexual predator Jeffrey Epps-Lees, including Donald and His Most Gracious Majesty's brother. Incredibly, not one of them had the slightest idea he was a sexual predator, even after he had been jailed for being a sexual predator. And none of them, not one of them, did anything wrong. Amazing, but who are we to doubt such honourable people? Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. You're on Solidarity Breakfast, as always, with Anila and Tobia, and you're here. We're here joined by
very special guest, Kieran, from the Anarchist Communist Federation. Would we be able to start off, Kieran, with a little bit of background about what the Anarchist Communist Federation actually is and what you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on this morning. Look, the Anarchist Communist Federation is celebrating a year this year. It's quite a new organization. It's a political organization committed to advancing anarchist communist politics in the union movement and in the working class in Australia. A bit about us and where we came from. There were small anarchist communist groups in several cities in Australia for some time. Previously, I was a member of the Melbourne Anarchist Communist Group. We had comrades up in Brisbane and comrades in Geelong, and we have a branch forming in Sydney. After a number of years of discussion and coming together and discussion about the need for a more serious and an ongoing anarchist communist organization in this country, we came together last year at our first conference, and we're preparing for our second this year.
Before, you know, we were back on air, you mentioned that your official title is member of the organisation, and it seems like most people are just considered to be a member of the organisation as per anarchist principles. I'd love to know a bit more about how you actually are internally kind of structuring and organising without, I guess, prescribing to a hierarchical structure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a member. All of the members are members. We don't have a formal executive. You know, there's not somebody in charge because we're anarchists. Each of our branches meets and discusses the issues that have come up. And we practice a principle of organization that we call delegation, which is, I've been delegated responsibility for promoting and organizing this conference. I've got a set of instructions from the meeting as to my scope for doing that. And I report back to the meeting. And what that means is that every member of the organization is in a position of, you know, broad political oversight of all of the political activities of the organization. We're a federation, and we use that word because this sounds strange to some people, but federal organizing, I think, is very important to anarchists. We've used the word federalism for a couple of hundred years to try and describe the idea that it's possible to have a large organization that's structured and organized without a center that's in charge, that there can be a decentralized functioning structure for an organization. The power of our organization is built to rest at the base in each branch. Branches send delegates that meet, discuss, and share information, but ultimately the decisions are made in meetings of all members.
And now that you've had a year of kind of organising and getting things done along those lines, have you kind of had any takeaways from organising that way? Have you found it to be efficient and effective?
Yeah.
Are there things that you think you would want to do differently in the coming year?
Yeah. In the discussions that we had about starting this organization, we really discussed, like, one of the things that's going to be really hard for us is that we're going to have to learn how to do the politics that we've been preaching, because we've been existing in these small groups that have had meetings. But what we've not been doing is coordination on a larger scale. And so this is going to be a new and learning experience for us. The process of doing this for a year still leaves me convinced that it is possible, absolutely, to have large and hopefully, like, I don't want to pretend that we're some kind of massive political organization yet. But if we don't believe that large organizations can operate without a center in control, then we need to abandon anarchist politics. And over the course of the past year, I'm yet to abandon anarchist politics.
And I think for me, it is one of the most kind of compelling parts of anarchism as a worldview, that it kind of is in some ways a process of how you actually engage politically rather than it being tied to a particular kind of discrete political outcome. So I'm very keen over the next few years to see how the organization emerges and the different strategies that you guys end up discovering as you go along and actually have to, you know, act in the world and figure out what works and what doesn't work. But the other reason that you're here with us today is that you've got a big event coming up, Anarchism 2026. Could you tell us a little bit about the event?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a public conference. We're presenting our politics to a wider audience. We're inviting people to come and discuss the key issues facing the Australian working class today. We're meeting on the 7th of March at Ballumballum Place in Brunswick. And these conferences, it's interesting. Like, it's both, a project of presenting our politics and saying what we're about and this kind of thing.
And but, I assume, kind of dispelling some of the myths about anarchism.
yeah, quite possibly. But it's also, I think, an important part of developing ourselves and our ability to function as a political organization. It's a structure test. Can we, with the model of organizing that we have, actually go and say, we're going to pull this off and we're going to, you know, have a large functioning event? So I think it's important for what is a small and new political organization to attempt these kinds of things.
Definitely. Can we hear a little bit more about what's on the program for the conference?
Absolutely. We've got a range of sessions coming up in sort of three broad streams. We wanted to talk about the basics of anarchist communist politics. We wanted to talk about the organizing work and issues confronting the working class in Australia today. And we wanted to talk about the major political issues out there. So for people who are interested in learning more about our approach and anarchist communist politics, we've got a couple of sessions, one I believe entitled Means and Ends, for those who are familiar with the phrase, Zoe Baker's recent book, Means and Ends, An Introduction to Anarchist Communism. We've got the perennial debate, Marxism and Anarchism. Is it a perennial debate, though? Because we hear these sessions put on by other organizations and other spaces that put up this combative Marxism versus anarchism. And I feel like I know the talk almost down to a script. And so we're having this conference and we're discussing, well, we're going to put on a session, Marxism and anarchism. But I think the conclusions will be a little different than what people walking into the room might expect based on if you come in having seen that talk 10 times. There are some myths we'd like to dispel.
Yeah. You've also got some great programming around things like gender issues and also specific struggles like Palestine and things going on in the education industry. Could you talk us through some of those topics and what an anarchist perspective specifically has to offer when we're talking about these types of challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if we're talking about major attacks on a segment of the working class today, we've got to be talking about the attacks on trans people. We've got to be talking about the right-wing reaction that is trying to push back and erode the rights and humanity of trans people. In that session, come along and hear a bit about our perspective and engage in the debate. And the key thing that I think we're going to be arguing, I think the key thing that's important, is that this is a working class issue and that working class organisations, unions and working class people have to fight for trans rights in defence of their own rights. If we don't fight for the rights of every segment of the working class, we're cutting our knees off and we're defeating ourselves by dividing ourselves. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more about what our comrades have to present on that topic. You want to ask me about that session? You should ask me about that session.
As I mentioned, you've also got some sessions about Palestine and the teachers' union. Could you go into a little bit more detail about those two?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, how can we talk about the issues confronting the working class on a global scale today without talking about the horrendous genocide in Palestine and the continuing struggle of the Palestinian people to live? And so we'll be talking about how, as the blurb says there, October 7th did not fall from the sky. It came out of decades of occupation, siege and dispossession and a colonial state built on force. And so we'll be talking about how, as anarchists, we understand that process, but also that question of how, as anarchists, do you engage in a struggle around national liberation? We're anarchists, we're opposed to the state form. Right? We think that the liberation of the working class requires the destruction of the state form. So how do you engage in a struggle that is, a people seeking national liberation when that aspiration is expressed in a struggle for a state form? So we'll be talking and tackling that thorny issue and making the case that absolutely we need solidarity with the Palestinian struggle as part of the broader working class struggle.
And these are some of the conversations that you've been continuing as well through your publication, Picket Line, which deserves more than a mention because it's one of the better publications that has come out over the last year. You're up to four issues now?
I believe issue five came out on Invasion Day.
So. I need to catch up. I need to catch that last issue. But maybe speak a bit about how this provided a voice for your organization to further these discussions and it's led to this conference.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, in building an organization, we decided one of the key things that's been lacking from anarchists in Australia for a long time is a consistent publication that explains what are our politics and what do we mean. You know, there, you know, there's a great zine culture, there's a great DIY culture, but what there is not in Australia at the moment is a consistent regular publication that says, okay, well, on these issues of the day, what are anarchists arguing? How can you see and understand this from an anarchist point of view? And so that was a big thing that we wanted to achieve with the publication.
I really like that the publication sort of doesn't have any authorship and kind of pushes a just a political voice that encompasses the outlook that you guys have as an organization. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate that the sessions also have a similar sort of vibe. Maybe a couple words on how that thought came into effect and how you guys carry out that work on a day-to-day basis.
It's a practical thing with the publication. I don't think there's an article in there that doesn't have at least four people work on it. You know, we sit together as a group and go, well, what is it that we need to talk about in the coming issue? And we have the brainstorming session around, well, what are the key things that we want to communicate? What are the key ideas we want to get across? The idea of putting a single author behind a draft sometimes feels a bit silly, and they do feel like products of the whole organization together, so it's not so much a position that we're like, no, we will never put an author's name next to a publication or anything like that. It's just it's just how it emerged in putting this stuff together.
Just as a collaborative effort.
It was and is a collaborative effort, and we could write the names of every single person in the branch underneath the publication. Or we could just say, this is the thing we worked on together and we're very proud to put out and see what you think.
Yeah, and so looking forward for the organisations, what are you guys, apart from obviously this important conference that's a stress test for your organisation, but are you guys planning any larger moves going forward into the year beyond this?
Absolutely. Look, a big focus of our politics is the need to rebuild a fighting workers' movement that can take forward the political ideas that are necessary. We're anarchist communists, but we're anarchist communists who are like, we don't argue that the entire working class must come around to our politics in order to achieve revolution. We argue that we have a set of ideas that will be interesting and useful for the working class in its struggle. We want to achieve anarchism and communism, but we're not under the delusion that our organization is the revolution. The revolution is the working class, and the working class has to fight in its own interests. And for the working class to fight in its own interests, it needs mass democratic organizations under the rank and file control of the working class. We would argue that the working class will be more successful in its fights when it organizes according to what we see as anarchist principles, that direct democracy with power built at the base. So a big part of our work is engaging in the struggle of the working class in Australia. That sounds very grandiose, but what does that mean in sort of three practical terms? When I look at the working class in Australia, the largest functional organizations, for all their faults, are still the unions. Where there are no unions, we need to build unions. Where there are unions, we need to fight to make them genuinely democratic, member-controlled organisations. And so a big part of our work, we run Organise Your Workplace trainings for building the union in places where there is no union. But we also meet, discuss, and strategise about how to intervene in union structures to advance the idea of genuine member-controlled base power in the unions.
I think, that makes me wonder what your perspective would be about how you include theory as part of these practical struggles. So what role, obviously anarchism in some ways has been, despite when you look into the ideas in anarchism, they're very intuitive. I think it's fairly inaccessible in some ways to the average person. I mean, it's barely even discussed at a university, let alone in kind of mainstream discussions of political ideas. So what would it look like to you to include these kind of theoretical positions in the practice of resisting?
This is a big reason why we founded and established the Anarchist Communist Federation. We need a structure that enables us to meet as anarchists, to discuss and understand the context that we find ourselves in, to study and understand the theory and say, does it have any insights for us in the struggle that we've got before us? And can we then take those insights and apply them in our work in organising in struggles? In practical terms, like the publication Picket Line is an attempt at showing that in practice. But another big part of the work we do in just trying to bring anarchist ideas and anarchist theory to people is we organise something we call the Anarchist Political School, which is just a regular series of discussions where people come together, people that we've met through our organising work, people interested in learning more about anarchism, to develop that basic understanding of the theory and ideas of anarchism that will hopefully equip them with a set of tools that they can then apply, engaged in organising in work, engaged in struggle in social issues, and on the streets in protest. I struggle to explain what that looks like in practice beyond join us and watch it. there's this sense, you know, a theorist that I'm particularly a fan of, you know, Errico Malatesta, Italian anarchist. I hate going on banging on about theorists because, here's a guy that you've never heard of who's dead. You know, what's the relevance of that to me? But in terms of, like, I find him deeply relevant and important. And he made an argument that I think is very true, which is, you know, we believe in anarchism and we've got this analysis and these ideas and we need to advance and build organization that can advance and disseminate and make these ideas useful ideas for the working class. But we can't substitute ourselves for working class organization and struggle. We need to build working class organization as working class organization. And this is sometimes called, in anarchism, organizational dualism.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting.
And just on that note, as in joining you, participating in your events, picking up a copy of Picket Line, which you can pick up at 3CR, at the offices of 3CR, as well as at many of your stalls that you have at Palestine rallies and other events, where can people stay informed with what the Anarchist Communist Federation is doing? And when is the event and how do people get tickets?
In all the most boring places, the internet at ancomfed.org. That is ancomfed.org. And all the usual annoying social media sites, places like Facebook and Instagram. And I believe we even have a TikTok. Help us. But the conference is coming up on Saturday, the 7th of March. It's at Ballumballum Place, which is in Brunswick at 15 Phoenix Street. And tickets are available and they're super expensive because it's super hard to book conferences on like this. Tickets are $5, available through our website, anconfed.org, or you can just show up. And if $5 is beyond your means, we can just spot you a ticket, get in touch. The other big way to get in touch with us would be, like, if you're interested in learning more about anarchist communist politics and our approach, we do put the Anarchist Political School on in several places around the city fortnightly, and details on sessions and how to get involved are available at our website, anconfed.org.
Beautiful. You guys do so much awesome work. Encourage everyone to take notice. We'll put all the links in the podcast to make sure. Kieran, any last words before we leave you, and maybe we'll hear from you in Asia Pacific Currents on the net coming up next?
Asia Pacific Currents coming up next. Is that the same Kieran? I don't know. any final words, I'll say, workers of the world unite, and to work, comrades, we've got a world to win.
Beautiful. Thanks very much to take the time of stopping by. Just a note, yeah, you can pick up Picket Line at 3CR. You can also pick up Jerry Georgiados's book, which you heard the interview that I did in Perth earlier this year. You can pick up his book. It's $50 on the door. All the proceeds will go to supporting Cleveland Dodd's brother and sisters to go to school. So you can find that at the door, as well as on Monday. Absolutely important that you come to 5:30 State Library to protest.
5:30 p.m. Don't show up really early in the morning.
Yeah.
I've made that mistake before.
That's it from us. Solidarity Breakfast, first episode down for the year, and we'll see you again next week.
You're listening to 3CR. an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Con Rafat dove puoi passare, se vai ogni giorno almeno per due settimane, perquisita nuda se tutto va bene, c'è chi attende un visto per potersi curare, la prima volta già ho corso verso il mare, la notte e le onde sui miei piedi, il calore e tutto il tempo che non smettevo di pensare alla gente di Gaza che lì non ci può andare.
اسمحوا لي ان اتكلم بلساني العربي قبل ان يحتل لغتي ايضا. Allow me to speak my Arab tongue before they occupy my language as well. Allow me to speak my mother tongue before they colonize her memory as well.
Di parlare, mi han picchiato e mi han chiesto
perché provi dolore,
e mi han rotto i denti, han detto ridi, hanno insultato i miei cari, han detto
siate comprensivi,
hanno interrotto i miei studi e mi han detto di imparare, mi hanno spinto verso il fuoco, detto di avanzare, mi han lasciato senza casa, han detto che fantasticavo, ho gridato verità e han detto che li attaccavo, mi hanno invitato ad una discussione, una pistola sulla testa e mi han chiesto, ho tenuto alta la fronte e ho gridato, sono
long story of power and pride, British Lord Vestey And Vincent Lignari were opposite men on opposite sides. Vesti was fat with money and muscle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean and spoke very little. He had no bank balance, hard dirt was his floor. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. The Ringi were working for nothing but rations. But once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily the pressure got tighter and tighter. The Ringi decided